Assalamu alaikum, peace be unto you. You're listening to From a Stranger to a Stranger as I try to adjust this audio here. It sounded like I blew out. Maybe I just won't talk so loud. I'm used to talking loud for my job, and so here, the microphone is, like, right by my mouth. So if I talk loud, it blows out the sound like it did in the beginning there. So it sounds like and looks like this is better. So I'll try not to blow it out. Anyway, you're listening to From a Stranger to a Stranger. My name is Issa Martel. Today is the 23rd. Of Dhulqa'dah, 1442 Hijri year, which corresponds to the glorious day of July the 4th, 2021. You know, it's interesting here. I worked earlier. Much reminds me of two stories. The first one is not really work-related, but it's that, did you notice, like, now, like, launching fireworks is, like, you got to worry about people, vets who had PTSD, and they might be scared of the boom-booms and all this, and, you know, like, screw them. That's basically what I have to say. I mean, like, no disrespect meant to anyone who is a veteran, you know, but come on, man, unless you were, like, from, I might even talked about this already, unless you're from, like, Vietnam or earlier and you were drafted, I can't feel too horribly bad for you, because especially this 9/11 20-year war thing, I mean, you knew what was going on when you signed up, you know, you knew this is what was going on. So, you know, and then on top of that, before you went over there, you most likely celebrated 4th of July with fireworks, you know, so, oh man, like, yeah, I just, you know, I get it, but I think that's a little bit much on the 4th of July, you know, come on, you can't shoot fireworks off in the good old US of A, you know, it's crazy that we celebrate our independence, right, by blowing stuff up. It's just like, yeah, here's some rockets we'll shoot up in the air, just in case, you know, you forget. But now everyone, I guess, has fireworks. It's not that big of a deal, but it's a thing, you know. It's funny, I guess, that our Independence Day is celebrated in this manner with blasts and guns and stuff, because it just symbolizes, like, the founding of our country. Like, our country, I guess, isn't founded on, like, some peaceful meeting of, like, a peaceful meeting of a council of elders. It was kind of in a way like that, but it wasn't like, you know, it this was after they, you know, committed treason to the UK, then rebelled against them, and then, you know, founded a new country, you know, on land which was, you know, not the Native Americans and all this. It's interesting when you think about it in all that way. And then we celebrate it by fireworks. But fireworks are, you know, a cool thing to shoot off, and it is, like, a celebratory thing now. Like, they're kind of downplayed, and, you know, everyone does it. It's the quote-unquote normal thing to do. You know, but when you think of it in when you go back in time, you know, to me it's I don't know, it's something. But that's not really the glorious day that I was talking about anyway. The glorious day I was talking about took place on July 4th in the year 1187 of our common era, and that was the Battle of Hattin, which was the battle, right, where Salahuddin took, I guess, Guy, right, and Renald. He took them captured along with Knights Templars, and they just, like, whooped the army. And this was before the Siege of Jerusalem when they were fighting the Crusaders. So this is kind of like the pre-battle to the Siege of Jerusalem. And it's in, if you watch Kingdom of Heaven, this battle is in there. They don't show the battle of, they don't show this specific battle in the movie, but they show like the Crusaders out and then like them basically getting overheated, because I believe what happened was that Salahuddin like cut off their water, or he filled the wells maybe or something. I think that's what happened. And then so the Crusader army was basically like run out of water and dehydrated and everything like that. So they just were decimated when the Salahuddin's army basically just waited for them and crushed them. I'm just looking here. I think this is just like Wikipedia. Yeah. Here you go. Yeah. This was on July 3rd. The Frankish army started out toward Tiberias, harassed constantly by Muslim archers. They passed the springs of Turan, which were entirely insufficient to provide the army with water. At midday, Raymond of Tripoli decided that the army could not reach Tiberias by nightfall, and he and Guy agreed to change the course of the march and veer to the left in the direction of the springs of Kafr Hattin, only 6 miles, 9.7 kilometers away. From there, they could march down to Tiberias the following day. The Muslims positioned themselves between the Frankish army and the water so that the Franks were forced to pitch camp overnight on an arid plateau near the village of Meshkenna. The Muslims surrounded the camp so closely that a cat could not have escaped. According to Ibn al-Athir, the Franks were despondent, tormented by thirst, while Saladin's men were jubilant in anticipation of their victory. Throughout the night, the Muslims further demoralized the Crusaders by praying, singing, beating drums, showing symbols, and chanting. They set fire to the dry grass, making the Crusaders' throats even drier. The Crusaders were thirsty, demoralized, and exhausted. The Muslim army, by contrast, had a caravan of camels bring goat skins of water up from Lake Tiberias, now known as the Sea of Galilee. Yeah, man, they like really were like, F you, Crusaders. but I mean, it sounds like the Muslims are, I mean, this is like typical warfare back then, you know, this is what you did. So they didn't really do anything out of line. And, you know, you may think if you're just knowing about this now, you may think this is, you know, horrible and like, oh, negative, against the Muslims, but these are how these big wars were fought back then. You had to move your army from water to water. You had to feed the army. That's like when you hear these stories of when the Crusaders moved through France and down to get here, they would go through and for like miles around like the train of crusaders, the villages would be just like ransacked and everything to try to keep the army fed. And, you know, so you had to move from water to water, especially here, like in the desert. You know, this is arid desert terrain. You know, if you didn't do that, you're basically screwed, which ultimately is what happened here. On the morning of July 4th, the crusaders were blinded by smoke from the fires set by Saladin's forces. The Franks came under fire from Muslim-mounted archers from the division commanded by Gokbori, who had been resupplied with 400 loads of arrows that had been brought up during the night. Jared, or is that Gerard, maybe, and Renald advised Guy to form battle lines and attack, which was done by Guy's brother Amalric. Raymond led the first division with Raymond of Antioch, the son of Bahamut III of Antioch, while Balian and Jocelyn III of Edessa formed the rear guard. Thursday demoralized the crusaders, broke camp and changed directions for the springs of Hattin, but their ragged approach was attacked by Saladin's army, which blocked the route forward and any possible retreat. Count Raymond launched two charges in attempt to break through to the water supply at Lake Tiberias. The second of these enabled him to reach the lake and make his way to Tyr. After Raymond's escape, Guy's position was now more desperate. Most of the it just goes on. Overwhelmed with thirst and wounds, many of Guy's soldiers were killed on the spot without resistance, while the remainder were taken prisoner. Their plight was such that five of Raymond's knights went over to Muslim leaders to beg that they be mercifully put to death. Guy attempted to pitch the tents again to block the Muslim cavalry. The Christian knights and mounted Sergians were disorganized but still fought on. I mean, they ultimately surrendered. But the thing that's about this battle is that Saladin kills here Renald of Châtillon, and this scene is actually in Kingdom of Heaven. This scene here, if you see it, Guy and Renald were brought to Saladin's tent. Saladin offered Guy a drink, which was a sign in Muslim culture that the prisoner should be spared. But Guy was unaware of that. Guy passed the goblet to Renald, but Saladin struck it from his hands and said, "I did not ask this evil man to drink, and he would not save his life by doing so." Then he charged Renald, breaking the truce. Some reports, such as that of Bahadin, claim that Saladin himself then executed Renald with a single stroke of his sword. Others record that Saladin struck Renald as a sign to his bodyguards to behead him. Guy assumed that he would also be beheaded, but Saladin assured him that kings do not kill kings. And in the movie, that's the line, but in the movie, there's more dialogue where Salahuddin then says, "Had you been close to a king, you would have known that," which was the slight, because Salahuddin had a truce with the king of Jerusalem who had leprosy, and there's the whole, and Guy wasn't part of like his crew, so he never learned like how to be like a true king in like diplomacy and everything like that, and how to like, I guess, like bargain and stuff with your enemies and treat them. So I mean, it's a. If you want to see this movie, Kingdom of Heaven, I only advise that you watch the director's version of it, because the one that was at the movie theater sucked. Yeah, they cut out like an hour and a half of the movie or something. I mean, they cut out so much. There's like a whole like subplot and story that takes place from the amount of footage like that's in it. So I think you need to watch it, that version, if you're going to watch this. But that's the real 4th of July right there. You know, so I don't know. The other thing I was going to say was that this morning I worked, right? So I'm at work. And today this whole week I'm working in dispatch at our garage. So at a certain point of the day, I'm the highest, or the dispatcher is the highest person in the whole building, because there's no management there, you know. So at that point, the dispatcher is the highest, you know, person of a you're basically running the garage right now. If you're running what's going on. So, which you do every day, I guess, but normally there's like, you don't have to really make managerial type decisions, which you don't really even have to in like when nobody's there. But it is what it is. So, and today, at one, like around 1 o'clock, the other dispatcher left. So I was, for 2 hours, I was there, until the next dispatcher came in, say at 3, you know, I forgot what time. I think the other guy left at 1 or something. So it was like 2 hours. And close to 3 o'clock, someone calls, like a bus operator, bus driver, and, is like, hey, when you guys did the markup, which the markup is the schedule of bus, it's like the what people who have to fill in work, like say, for example, a person calls off, somebody has to cover that work for the bus, because the bus, I mean, there's like other people that depend on the bus to run. So if you call off of work, somebody literally has to cover that work, because there has to be a bus there. You know, like when if they cut bus trips, it's really a big deal to cut a trip, because they can't cover it or something. But to cut like a whole shift is like an impossible thing to do. So anyway, so part of the dispatcher's job is to make the whole schedule for what's called the extra board, which are these people that basically sit in the garage all day, and they cover these shifts. That if people call off or people have a vacation day or something, there's this pool of people that only work what is called the extra board. And the extra board is this basically a board, because back in the day it was like a board, like a board with extra drivers on it that to cover this. So and so you have, for example, everybody who had a vacation day scheduled for today, everyone that calls off and all this, you have that list, right, of all those shifts that need to be covered. So you take this pool of people and assign them to cover all this work that needs to be done. So that's part of your job. So anyway, this guy calls. It's like, say it's 2:30, because I leave at 3. This guy calls and he's like, yo, you gave me this extra piece of work for overtime tomorrow, but you had me start at 4:45 a.m. and I said I wanted to start at 5, right? So I'm like, okay, let me look. And I started looking through the paperwork and stuff, but he was actually working now when he called. So he was on the layover between when he ended the bus trip at like the one end. He's on the layover, which is the time between that ends and he has to like turn around and go back. So he was like, okay, I'll call you back then. And so in the meantime, I looked through the papers and stuff and found that when he signed up, he called the other guy that was there this morning and told him this, but the other guy didn't write on our like master list that this operator, the driver, technically a bus driver is called a bus operator, so the operator the other dispatcher didn't write that this operator had said he wanted to start at 5, right? So he called back, and the reason he was calling was because so much stuff, so many people are not here yesterday and, or today and tomorrow, that tomorrow there's a lot of overtime that people can do. And there was more little shifts that are like 2 hours, like this thing was at like 5, that didn't get filled, you know, so we have this list and he sees this. So he's saying, well, why can't you? I told him five, he has me starting at 4:30. Why can't you just give me one of the 5 o'clock ones and just switch it? Which I could do, but there's like in the mechanics of the computer system, there's like something I have to do if I did that and I didn't remember what that was, right? I told him that, and he's like, look, if you just don't want to do it, then just don't do it. And I was like, look, can you just call back? Because now this call that's happening right now, this when he called back, it's 2:50 and I leave at 3. And the other guy comes in at 3, who is like another, I've only been doing this job like half the time for the past 6 months. You know, so this is only the second time that I had to asked to do this, to remove someone from the overtime and switch it. And which is also a big deal to do because the overtime is given out according to your seniority. So if you sign up for overtime, right, if you're the number one person on that list for seniority wise, you get the longest piece of overtime, right? So if there's one that's 10 hours tomorrow, you know, and then the next one's 9 hours, and then the next one's 8 hours. The first person on the list gets the 10-hour one, then the second. So it has to be in the order, like, of descending. So the high, like, when we say, like, he has high seniority, he's really, like, he has a lot, I guess. But, you know, those people get that. So in the order, right, if I remove someone and switch it, right, the person after them, if they like kind of notice it, they can go like, well, why didn't I get that piece of work then? You know what I mean? So if I, this guy who wanted to start at 4:45 a.m., right, if I could easily just go in the computer, I mean, it's like a, you just like highlight it and click cut, you know what I mean? And it just takes it off. It's not like a thing, but if you do that, because this is overtime and this whole seniority thing, it triggers like other events to happen. And I didn't remember how to like cover these other events. And so it didn't like trigger all these errors and all this stuff and have people then, you know, be like, well, I wanted that. I could have had that piece at 4:45. Why didn't I have it? You know, and then, you know, the person after that, well, why didn't I get it in this? So it's really a pain to do. And normally people don't do it. And in this case, I'm telling him, I don't have any proof that he said he wanted to start at 5 o'clock because there's nothing written when he called. Normally, if you call and say you want to sign up for overtime, okay, do you have any restrictions, meaning like you don't want to do route 21 or you only want to work this hour or whatever. So that part of the Excel form was not filled in. It was blank, which normally means that that person would be available for however, what time, whatever time, however long, whatever you need them for, that person can, you know, will cover it without any complaints. So the operator is saying that he told this other guy who earlier that was there earlier that he said 5 o'clock. Now the other guy had left now, right? So I couldn't like just be like, yo, did he say this? Yeah, okay, well, we screwed up. We got to redo this part here. I couldn't ask him because he was gone. So I'm the only one there. Now there's no management there. I'm the top person in the garage now, right? And I said, look, I can't cut it off for you, but I need to do something else, and I don't remember what that was. Can you just wait 10 minutes or call back in 10 minutes, right? And I was like, you work until 6 o'clock. I'm looking at his schedule on the computer, right, and all the time points where he stops and can call, which is basically like every 20 minutes. So I was like, hey, can you just call back? When so-and-so's here, he'll be here in 10 minutes, and then he can do it. Well, if you don't want to do it, then just don't do it. Just tell me you don't want to do it, but I know you can do it. And I'm like, yeah, I can do it, and I can do this. And then he's like, well, you know, like you, I know you can do it. And he's kind of like, what did he say? He was like, how long have you been dispatching? I know you can do this and that. And once you get into, like, once you call in, right, and ask me to do something, and then if I'm like, okay, I mean, I'm still relatively new at doing this, you know, and I mean, it's know that everybody knows that, you know, and then you start telling me like my job description at that point, I'm just like, look, I'm going to hang up on you. You know what I mean? I'm just like, whatever. So that's, you know, this guy's like, you know, this, and I was like, look, you know, if you don't want it, he's like, I'm not going to call back anymore. I'm blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, whatever. You know, but I can't help you. I was like, if you want it done, you need to call back. And he worked till 6 o'clock today also. So, and when he, which means he would have to come back to the garage to get his car to leave, you know, so he could come in. He had like, you know, time to come. It was just like really weird. And, you know, he seemed really annoyed. So it ain't my problem. Oh, and then he was like, this was the thing. This is what triggered it. I was like, okay, you want to be like that? Then we're going to go this way. He was like, well, I'm just going to not come, and I'm not going to call again. And all the phones are recorded, so I'll just have them pull the tape of the phone. And I was like, okay, you know what? Well, now I ain't doing shit for you, you know? And I was just like, all right, go ahead and do that, you know, because you're going to lose. You're going to lose because, you know, he could have called back in 10 minutes. He could have called back in like 25 minutes. He could have called back in increments of 20 minutes for the next 3 hours, and then could have came into the garage and when he was done and said to whoever's there, hey, can you do this, you know? And I told him that, look, you know, I told him the situation, which is true and it's valid. So it's just like, I don't understand like why you would make this big fuss. But that type of attitude, you know, is just like, oh no, man, you don't get to tell me what to do. Basically, that's it. So anyway, those were the two things I wanted to like talk about before like what I really want to talk about. And I went to an NA meeting. How long is it? So it's like a half hour now. Yeah, so we'll just keep talking if this goes long, whatever. I was in Pennsylvania, and I was staying at my sister's house, and she's getting married in September. So I was talking to her fiance and stuff, and he's like, owns a business there and has he owns a business and has some clients that are you know, they're famous in their fields. So he has like a big history of drug use. And he happened to be 9 years ago living on the streets of Philadelphia. And he has since turned his complete life around and is doing really well. And so, in us talking, and he's, I guess they're like born again Christian or something. I don't really know what they are. But it's one of these churches where, you know, they have a little band and they sing, and there's like a woman with like twirling flags, dancing, like this type of thing. So it's this type of Christian experience. So we were talk about a lot about religion, obviously, since I'm staying in his house for like a week. And he was like, "Do you want to go to this AA meeting with me? Because my brother-in-law, future brother-in-law, I guess, he the person who he was sponsoring, it was like their year anniversary of being sober. And this person, I guess when you hit a year anniversary like this or something, you give a little like talk and you have like somebody else you can recommend or get a guest speaker or something. So he had my brother-in-law be this person that he picked, even though he was his sponsor also. But my brother-in-law's story is really good, and he knows how he also does a little public speaking, so he obviously knows how to speak and can make the story be really engaging by the phrasing and how he talks and this type of thing. So I was like, "Yeah, dude, I'll go along, you know, and I'll listen to your, you know, I'll listen to it. That sounds, you know, no problem at all." I was like, "All right." So we go to this, and this place is in Easton, Pennsylvania, is where he meets. So I'm sitting there, and the place is pretty packed. It was like at this little church on, I don't know what part of Easton that is. I guess that would be the east side of Easton, or the south side of Easton, I guess. If the river is on the eastern border, yeah, that would be the south side of Easton. If there is a south side, I don't know, but it's in the southern quadrant of Easton, I guess. And you know, so I go there and I'm listening to him talk, and I listened to, first off, the guy who it was his anniversary, he really said some powerful, I don't know, powerful, I'm going to use powerful to be like PC and nice sounding and, you know, whatever. But his story was really good, because his story, he had relapsed. He had been sober for a long time and then relapsed, and then last year went sober again. So it was his year anniversary off of that. And oh, that was really, really like a nice thing to hear. And then I listened to my brother-in-law start talking, and I had heard his quote-unquote story, I guess. But I never heard him tell it like this. And I had known that he does these talks, not just at NA, but, kind of like motivational speaking, or I know he has done some, and I believe that's the direction that he kind of wants to go in this type of thing, which, you know, it was good. You know what I mean? And I asked him beforehand, before we went, I asked him if he, like changes it a little bit, like tweaks it before he talks, and he was like, "Yeah." So I think he does like a kind of like fit it to whomever the audience is or whatever the reason. But it was pretty good, and it made me think, right? It made me think that like it is like 30. Wait, hold on a second. 95, 2005, 2015. So 26 years, right, since I had been in Northampton County Prison, right, or jail, I guess. It's called the prison, but it's actually the county facility. So I was in there from 1996 to 1998. And so during this time, so now I'm sitting in Easton, right? And I'm listening to these people talk. Because then after he talked, and then in an NA meeting, like, they kind of go around and people can just talk and share whatever's going on or experiences or whatever, you know. And so I listened to a bunch of people, and I was doing that, I had thoughts or reflected upon this thing. I was sitting there, I was like, man, it's been like the last time I was at an NA meeting was 25 years ago when I was in Northampton County Jail, right? So it made me think, like, look at, like, all, like, how my life has gone, right? And this, like, window of time here. You know, it's really crazy when you think about it. And then it's like been from, I went from there, Pennsylvania. After I got out of jail, I had some jobs there for a couple of years. I had to be on parole for 2 years. So this would have been now in like 2000. I was done with parole, and but I still had like jobs in Pennsylvania, maybe till like 2006. And when I moved overseas. And then I had, so now in 2006, right, taking the step to live or attempt to live basically to travel overseas, just that point from the period of being incarcerated until that was like a major like thing, right? Which most people, and the only reason I was going over jail is, I mean, the whole reason that led me to do that is because I had converted to Islam while I was in the jail, right? So, you know, that jail experience, you know, basically put a specific direction of my life from that point, right? And the major key points in my life since then were related to me being Muslim. Because if, had I not been Muslim, I mean, I would not have left the U.S. You know, I mean, that's pretty much, I mean, I might have in for some other reason, but the whole reason I left Pennsylvania and had gone to Saudi Arabia first was because I taught English in Saudi Arabia then, you know, and that was only because I was Muslim, because I had met another Muslim in Bethlehem who was a professor in Riyadh, right? And he happened to be doing some work at Lehigh University, which is in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is where I had lived at the time. And so, you know, he was like, look, you know, maybe I can try to hook you up with a deal, something over here. And he did after when he went back, and a couple months later, this was in 2005, but I had went over there, and it was 2006 by the time I had gone over there. And he, I worked at the Saudi British Center. And after my first, I had a 90-day summer contract. But then after the 90 days, I didn't like living, there under the contract of like one of these places. I didn't like how the contract was, basically. So I was like, okay, I want to, I don't want to go back to the U.S. Maybe I can, because I'm out of the U.S., right? Getting out of the U.S. is like the hardest thing to do. And so I went back to Morocco, which me and my housemate Mike and my friend Josh had gone to like a couple years earlier. I think we went in like 2001. We went to Morocco, I believe. So I had been there before, and the main thing was that my friends in Riyadh, the co-workers of mine, some were Egyptian, some were Jordanian, they were like, those countries around Saudi Arabia, like your U.S. passport you can go to and they give you a visa at the border. Which in other countries coming to America, that's not the case. You need to get like apply for a visa like ahead of time and do this. But your American passport gives you the lovely ability to just travel to any country and walk into it. You know, so it's crazy. It's literally crazy when you, if you don't know like the level of playing, like the level of the geopoliticalness that the United States is, you need to know, because you know you need to travel and you need to see these other countries and this type of thing. So we had around, like every country is basically you can stay in that country for 30 days. But in Morocco, you can stay there for 90 days, right? So I thought, well, in 90 days is a larger window of time. I mean, I have enough money now to from working these past 3 months in Saudi Arabia. I mean, part of your contract of working there is that you get free housing. So you don't have to pay for anything. You just have to pay for your food, but you're getting like still getting paid like a crap ton of money. So, you know, I easily had enough money to live for 3 months. And I was like, well, you know, if it don't work, then I'll just go back to the U.S. after 3 months. But that's like a longer period of time that I can, you know, stay out of the U.S. and be like just wandering the earth. So that's what I did. So, but all that and Morocco was also because like a Muslim thing. I was like, I wanted to go to a Muslim country and see how the Muslims lived and lived with them. Not that living here with Muslims, you can't do or whatever, because there's a crap ton of Muslims in Minneapolis, you know, I mean, it's huge amount of Muslims, but it's different if you're in a country that's, you know, quote unquote Islamic, or Muslim majority country. So that's another thing, you know, that stems from this original, you know, of premise of me converting to Islam while in the prison. And then, of course, my wife, you know, is Muslim, so we met that way, and I got kids, you know. My kids' names, Saifuddin is one of my oldest kid, and Ukasha is my other kid. So it's like, it's in us, you know, that's like the culture that it is. So, you know, a lot of this all, you know, stems to that. And in this period while I was there, you know, I was at Pennsylvania. Now we're in the present again. I was visiting my sister and we went to the NA meeting. You know, I thought about all this while I was sitting in the meeting, like, man, this is really like a wild thing that I've kind of gone like a full, I didn't go full circle, like, in a negative sense, because to me that would imply that, okay, I'm living in Pennsylvania again and, you know, my life is basically just like blah. So that didn't happen. I mean, go full circle in coming back to Easton, you know, really like I said, the last time I was in a meeting like that was, you know, 25 years prior. So, and just reflecting on like, everything that's transpired in 25 years, you know, and even like the NA thing, right? So when in the 90s, a big thing about NA, you know, it really kind of was a Christian thing, right? So that was always an issue I had with it. And to address that issue, I guess, at least in the 90s, they implemented like the concept of, well, you can just the concept of a higher power, and that concept could kind of be anything, even a rock, you know, that could be a higher power, you know. So oops, I just knocked something down. It could be your higher power that way. But I always thought that was whack. You know, I'm like, come on, man. A rock, a chair, right? You need to come up with something better than that. And then my higher power ain't gonna be Jesus. So you can kick that right out of your mind, too. So now they used more ambiguous terminology. And that is like, your higher power in however way you see it or see him or it or something. It's like some vague how you understand your higher power as or the concept of God as you understand it. You know, I think that's more of a phrase that they used. The concept of a higher power or God as you understand it. You know, so it is trying to be more inclusive now. In the sense that, you know, there anyone can be in it. But it still had like a very cultish type of feel, and I can see easily how, and this is not in any way a negative to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or anything like this, because for not just some, for a lot of people, the reality is that it works for them. You know, a lot of people really, you know, commit to it and do it. But to me, you know, it's kind of like feeding your addiction still with something else, right? So, you know, my brother-in-law happened to have been, I guess I shouldn't say because all this happened in NA, but he tells this story himself, so I feel that I can say it because it's a thing that he tells. But he was like a severe addict, right? And for him, this worked, right? It changed his life completely. But my point is like, if you take away the drug, you still have the addiction. So you still have the void that needs to be filled. And it easily, you can see at these meetings, like this one dude, the same meeting, it was like his 30th year of being sober. And he said he had gone to the meetings like every week for 30 years. Right? So, you know. Does it not seem that the structure of the meeting or whatever like plugged the hole that you left from the drugs to feed your addiction, to have your addiction to focus on something? I personally see addiction as a thing. You know, so if you, it don't matter if you're an addict, you're an addict or you're not, you know. So, but if you're an addict, then you got to do something to appease your addiction, the addiction, right? And it doesn't have to be like a drug addiction. It could be like a food addiction, sex addiction, whatever, like buying, compulsive buying addiction type of thing. Like all these weird things are like addictions that people have in the term, in my term, you know, of my concept of how addiction is like a thing. You know, so all these people have this, so you need to fill it. Now, you can easily argue, well, you filled your addiction with religion, and a lot of people do that, and that's where I kind of think that it's culty, NA, you know, or NA, these, or AA, these things are kind of cultish in this regard, but you can do that. You can say that. In my case, I mean, I guess it could be kind of true. I guess it could be kind of true. But the fact is that I really just had stopped doing, like, hard drugs, I guess. But I still smoked weed. You know, and if my job did not, if I didn't have like a government job that requires a CDL, which requires random drug testing, I'd still smoke some weed now too. So well, I have gone times though without smoking weed, or, you know, so I've gone years, you know, the whole time I was in Morocco and living overseas, I didn't smoke over there at all, you know. And even now, I mean, here, because this is 8 years of my job, you know, I've been working at my current job. So, you know, but so I guess my point is that's like the evidence against the saying that me particularly filled that with religion, because I don't think I did. I kind of have like, other things that I do as well that I think more fit filling that gap, because you know, religion for me, Islam just became a lifestyle, not just a religion, I believe that Islam itself, right, is a lifestyle, not a religion. So the term religion is used because there are religious aspects of it. But a term that I feel is better describing of, like, the word in Arabic is deen, like your deen. And they use this to, in the Quran, it's used to be like in reference to, in the Quran says that I, meaning the Creator, Allah, speaking here, says, I chose Islam as your deen. Or I made Islam as your deen, you know. So deen there, the total encompassing thing of Islam is your lifestyle, because you have to ultimately change your lifestyle. I mean, that's basically what it is. And you know, you probably through time, like everything, as people understand things more and gets older or whatever, you know, you adapt your lifestyle to do that. But that, I feel, is more of a better way of describing it. Because for religion, when you think of religion, you think of that it's something that people do, like, also with their lifestyle, right? But I feel that because Islam is a very constant, like if you practice Islam on a base level of, okay, I just pray, that's it. I pray 5 times a day. That's my max extent. I pray 5 times a day. I fast during Ramadan. If that's like your base thing of Islam, I mean, that's still like a serious lifestyle thing that you're living, because you have to pray, like you make it a point to pray 5 times a day, and you, majority of the people
aren't around, you know, if you're out working or something, you kind of, you know, got to figure out how to do that. So you have to adjust your lifestyle in a sense to be able to do that, right? So that's why I feel it's like that. Whereas with Christianity, you know, most, the vast majority of the people go to church like on Sunday, but during the week there is no, like there's no communal prayer thing, you know, unless they do it amongst themselves, but the religion itself doesn't dictate this. So you can pretty much go and, you know, live however and then go to church on Sunday. But most Christians aren't going to do that, but I'm sure, I hope you can still see or get what I'm getting at with that. That I can more see Christianity as a religion than a lifestyle in opposed to Islam. Because Islam definitely is a lifestyle. Because, like, for example, the fasting, right? In Islam, you're told you gotta, you know, you gotta fast. If you're able to, you gotta fast. You know, but there's no fasting, real fasting in Christianity. And you know, I use the term real fasting because Lent is not like a fast, you know what I mean? So, but there is that, you know. So, and it's ironic, just speaking of fasting, how intermittent fasting is like a huge thing now, you know. But you know, I won't even go into it. You know, it's, I'm sure if you listen to me, I'm sure you can kind of know the direction that would go in. So anyway, being an Easton again made me like think like, man, you know, alhamdulillah, you know, my life kind of came full circle and just made me think about like all that stuff, you know, and perhaps I would have thought about it, but probably not, you know. I probably would have kept, if had I not gone to Pennsylvania and had I not gone there to that meeting, I wouldn't have been in Easton, so I wouldn't have even thought about this type of stuff, you know. So, you know, it's all perspective and it's all kind of interesting, but it did make me reflect about my life and, you know, what I've done and how it's gone. So we'll end it here. It's like an hour. Thanks for listening. If you've made it this long, hope you had some July 4th activities that were fireworks and not beheading your enemy. But if you did do that today, yeah, good. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. Have a good day.